Good morning. Happy Mother's Day. Feels like spring today. Wow. It felt like spring a while ago. Went away, right? So, this morning, I'm going to talk about Zen and the comic spirit. Zen and the comic spirit. So, Buddha's mission was a serious one. When he set out on his endeavor, his quest, he was serious. The quest to move beyond our small, chattering, upset self is a serious one. He did it with some gravity, with some solemnity. He put aside the frivolity and sensuality of his early life because he really cared about this quest. He really cared about it. So from that point of view, laughter seems to represent the superficial. We're evading and ignoring deeper issues of life and death. And almost all religion has this tone to it, of wanting to move beyond the lower sensual regions because we feel caught by them. So we want to move beyond them. We want to transcend them. And in medieval physiology, the seat of laughter is the spleen. The spleen is full of yucky stuff, right? It's full of yucky stuff. Dark, the stomach, the intestines, sacs, organs, bladder. So that's kind of the way religion tends to go. And there's an important component to that, a very important component to that seriousness. In contrast to religious conversation, we have comic conversation. Watch a stand-up comic on TV, or go hear a stand-up comic. Read William Chaucer or William Shakespeare. What are they talking about? What's the comic stuff about? Sex, food, evacuation. Watch Amy Schumer. How many of you watched Amy Schumer? Raise your hand if you watched Amy Schumer. One, two, three. Raise your hand. I want to see how many of you. Okay. What's she talking about? Sex, evacuation, and eating. Isn't she funny? Don't we love her? Don't we love her? She's not religious, but we love her. We laugh. So in contrast to religious conversation, that's comedic conversation. Shakespeare's comedies too. So that's interesting, isn't it? Interesting. In the 4th century in India, they categorize 6 levels of humor. The Buddhist scholastics. I don't think they had enough to do, those Buddhist scholastics. They categorize 6 levels, from the grossest, the most sensual, to the most profound, the most divine. The most profound, the most divine, we see in the early Buddha statues, early Buddha figures. A faint smile. Serene, subtle, refined. And that's the highest level. The lowest level is the belly laughter level. So before Zen, that was generally not what Buddhists did. And of course, I'm generalizing here, right? And what do I really know? I just know what I read. That's all. The lower level of humor and identification with the sensuality, that was the folly of the unenlightened. So that's the sort of religious schema that's present worldwide. And I won't say it's present in major religions, present in the major religions. I can't speak for all the different shamanic religions. That's a whole different talk. So what happens when Zen develops in China? Lucky for us, what happens? Well, in China, there's already Taoism is present when Buddhism comes into China. And the Taoists are always telling jokes. They're always making fun of themselves and everyone, a lot of roaring with laughter. And then we've got this guy in India who's just done a major transformation in Buddhism in India named Nagarjuna, who's just developed this radical non-dualism that stands our religious schema, our religious hierarchy on its head. So Nagarjuna and the Heart Sutra show the incongruity of any and all belief systems that are hierarchical. They're all, and undercuts each one logically. So if you've taken a class in Nagarjuna here, how many of you are familiar with Nagarjuna? Raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. So he uses logic. He uses logic to cut away our hierarchy, our duality, our either-or, spiritual, mundane duality. Cuts it away. So we have those two strands coming together in China, producing Zen. Chan in China. And Nagarjuna shows the incongruity of any and all belief systems that we get attached to by undercutting them logically. And Zen teachers, Chan teachers, use absurd behaviors and laughter in order to awaken us and liberate us from our beliefs, right? That we get attached to. Same goal, different strategy. So humor then, as it develops in Chan and then moves into Japan and Zen and here, is a teaching technique and an expression of a way of life when we're not caught by before and after. Because when you have a good laugh, you ain't caught by before and after. Ever notice that? You're pretty much in the present, right? How can you be anywhere else when you have a good laugh? So, examples here, they're in Chan, China's Chan, right, Japan Zen. Here's an example. There was a Zen master in the 8th century. Every time the full moon came out from behind a cloud and he would come out of the Zendo, he would see it and he would burst into uproarious laughter. And Zazen ended at like 9:30 at night, and the people in town had to close all their windows and stuff their doors with cloth because the laughter disturbed their sleep. And a Chinese monk, Shui Lao, he said, His master kicked him in the chest, and we won't get into that, although there's some humor in that, too. I know it sounds not humorful, but kicked him in the chest, resulting in his enlightenment. Afterwards, the monk said, "Ever since the master kicked me in the chest, I've been unable to stop laughing." So that was the kicking, and you have to understand this is the context of a meditative environment. So the master just doesn't arbitrarily go around and kick people. It's like he wants to precipitate giving birth to this joy of living. So he sees when the student is stuck, and he maybe gives him a little kick. I have never done that. I probably would not do that because I might get arrested, or you know. The psych board would certainly find out about it. But we had no psych board back then. This is about a mind unburdened by thought. That's what this practice is about. We carry this burden around of thought. Nagarjuna deconstructs it logically. And we go down that path with them. Zen teachers deconstruct it through a hearty belly laugh. A hearty belly. Hara laugh. Hara, right? In Zen, priests wear, some Japanese Zen priests wear haramachis around their, which is to protect the warmth of your hara, your belly laugh. Because the seat of your power is in your chi, which is right here in your hara, right? Something like that. Don't believe it, though. Don't make a religion out of it, you guys. Just enjoy it. Just listen to it. So the teacher is attempting to help the practitioner open up and not be caught by his or her thoughts or feelings, not be stuck on anything. And in comedy, what? Enlightenment and liberation are kind of like getting the point of the joke. When you get the point of the joke, you just open up, and you don't know. You don't even know. You don't need to know because you're alive. You're getting the point of the joke. You're alive. A sudden release of the tensions that are produced by Tim, which comes through the sitting practice. Even if the release only lasts this long, there's a release. There's a release. So, and there are all kinds of Zen stories about this and about teachers, you know, kind of playing with their students and things like this. So I think you have to turn that clock, Jim, so I can see it. Because if I start telling my story, sometimes I forget about time. And time is an important construct, even though it's just a fabrication. Okay, so what's the story? So the story is, so I'm with my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi. And I've been with him in a story. This is many years ago. I'm at Tassajara, the Zen monastery. I've been with him. Then I go home to visit my mother. Then I come back to the monastery. And then he calls me into his room, and he says to me, "Your mother called me." And I thought, oh no, my mother called him? I'm a young man. You know, I've been practicing for 3 years. I'm about 24 years old. But what's my mother? He said, "Yes, your mother called me. He said, I'm going to visit her." I thought, oh no, you're going to visit her? What do you mean? Give me a break. I'm finally trying to disengage a little bit, and you're going to entangle with my mother and my whole family system. No, no, no. Anyway, that's not the point of my story. I'm just remembering how I felt. Your mother called me. And I kind of went, ugh. And he said, oh, well, I think she notices that you have changed, that you've turned into a beautiful swan. And I thought, oh, a swan. She sees my practice, and he sees it too. It's 3 years I've been really busting my butt, and now I'm a swan. And he looks at me, and he says, or maybe she thinks the swan has turned into an ugly duckling. And I go, oh, an ugly duckling. So, humor, right? It didn't seem humorous to me at the time, but in retrospect, humor. A swan, an ugly duckling, you know, the highest level of humor, the lowest level, the unconditioned, the conditioned, sexuality, amorality, all, you know, all one flow, all one flow. And laughter can help us with that. And my teachers had a Buddhist name too, and we only give people nice Buddhist names, but his teacher called him what? Crooked Cucumber. And Suzuki Roshi would tell me that, and he would laugh. He would laugh. Crooked Cucumber. We're all crooked cucumbers. We all fall down. Can we laugh at our falling down and just that our crooked cucumbers turn into pickles half the time and just be present with what is? So these Zen teachers, these Chan teachers also mocked. And the Japanese teachers too, but the Chinese teachers more. Because the Chinese teachers were less polite than the Japanese teachers. They mocked the founding fathers. You guys know this. Umon was asked, what is Buddha? He said, a shit-wiping stick. Many, many stories like this. Many, many stories. We don't talk about them here. I don't know why. Maybe, I don't know why. We're Midwestern, I guess. But shit-wiping stick. That's who Buddha is. So collapsing the hierarchy and just being alive, because we created this hierarchy. It's made up. It serves a purpose, but it's just made up. So breaking down the categories which divide up our experience, sacred and profane, sublime and ordinary, beauty and ugly, swan, ugly duckling, swan, enlightenment, delusion. So then these Zen masters, these Chinese guys, but some of the Japanese guys seem often like clowns or fools. Well, sure. Seppo, Zen master Seppo. His thing was to teach whenever anybody would ask him a question, he had three wooden balls, and he would just throw the wooden balls out on the floor and then turn around and leave. Anytime he got a question, he threw out his three wooden balls. Oh, that puzzles you. You don't understand that. But he's trying to break down our conceptual framework of trying to get something through our concepts and just be alive. Just be alive. Gute, famous master, Zen master Gute, is one-fingered Zen. Huh? Put up one finger. I don't know if he put up this finger or this finger. Maybe sometimes he did this finger and sometimes he did this finger. I don't know. One finger Zen. That was his whole style, his whole life. Maybe sometimes this finger. Maybe depending on what mood he was in, right? Ryokan, the great Japanese Zen master wrote Ryokan, who was called the Great Fool. And if you studied him, if you read Ryokan, you'll see how foolish he was. One of his favorite things was playing with kids. He played hide and seek with kids. And I don't know if this story is apocryphal or not. It probably is apocryphal, but anyway, whatever. I mean, it shouldn't be too apocryphal because this is the 18th century. But anyway, the story is one night he was playing hide and seek with kids. And, you know, he would just give himself to the experience of being with kids. Just give himself. As we can, as through Zen, we give ourselves to whatever our experience is. We just are there. We just are there. So he was playing hide and seek with kids, and he went and he hid in a barn under a haystack. And the farmer came out the next morning, and there was Jokon still hiding under the haystack. And the farmer pulled up the hay, and Jokon said, "Are they gone?" I know. The great fool, Jokon. You can read, you know, we did a whole course on him last year. Charlie Chaplin. You guys are too young. You're not too young. Bowler hat, dress coat, walking cane, baggy pants, floppy shoes. So once a story I haven't told in a while, so I had my grandmother over to dinner in San Francisco because she was Catholic and she wanted to meet this priest who was my Zen teacher. And, you know, and so my young wife cooked the dinner and Suzuki came over and we had a little cat, a little kitten. And the kitten saw Suzuki. Suzuki had his traveling robes on and he saw his how his traveling robes were just kind of out there. And he started batting at the robes. And then he batted. And then Suzuki batted back at him. And then he batted more at the robes. And then Suzuki batted out at him. And pretty soon they were playing. And in my imagination, but I think this is just my imagination. I'm sure this is just my imagination. But, you know, you tell these stories and they get larger and larger. So now in my imagination, they're rolling on the floor together. And they're both black. And my grandmother is just looking. Just looking. So I don't actually know what happened, except that they were batting at each other. And then my grandmother said afterwards, when I called her up, "Oh, how did she, you know, had she enjoyed meeting him?" She says, "Yes, I enjoyed meeting that man. And you said he was a priest, didn't you, dear?" And then 6 months later, my grandmother mentioned me. "Yes, I met that man with you. He's your teacher. You said he was a priest, didn't you, dear?" And then a year later, she said, "And that man who is your teacher, you said he was a priest, didn't you, dear?" And those of you who are Catholics know what some Catholicism is, and you know what I'm talking about, right? And I said, "Yes, Grandma, he's a priest." And I said, "Grandma, I want to be one too." And she said, "Dear, that kind of priest?" Well, sure, why not? Why not? All kinds of priests, right? So then we have Zen art. Oh, Zen art. Do I have my Zen art with me? Yes. Yes. So there. There's a little. Let's see if I've got all my Zen art. Maybe I forgot some of it. No, there's two guys, and here's two guys. This one is Hanshan and Shite. Hanshan and Shite. And this is 9th century. And you see they're doing the worst kind of laughter from early Buddhist point of view, the most raucous, sensual kind of laughter. And Hanshan and Shite hung out together outside the monasteries. They played tricks on people. They begged for food, played tricks on the monks, had a good time. Hanshan usually has a broom to wipe off our the thoughts that we get caught on through his hilarity, through his joking. And Shite usually has a blank scroll because Hanshan has showed him how to wipe off the stuff that gets stuck to him so he can be a blank scroll. So, and there they are. There those guys are. And Hanshan, of course, is also the famous poet, famous Cold Mountain poet. And now we've got, here we have Putai or Gute. Putai or Gute. Let's see, what is he? Putai in China, Gute in Japan. And many of you have heard me talk about this guy before. This guy is an incarnation of Maitreya Buddha, the future Buddha. But what is he? He's fat. he's doing a belly laugh, and you see him in Chinese restaurants. When you see those Buddhas in Chinese restaurants, you often wonder, well, what's the deal there? But it's Hote, it's Putai. And he's enjoying a really good belly laugh. His belly is pronounced. And he carries a sack on his back. This is his practice as a Zen teacher. Carries a sack on his back that's full of tangerines or oranges. And he passes them out to kids. And then when he sees people like Ann and me, he asks us for money so he can buy more oranges for kids. So there he is. There's Putai, Hote. So this is our tradition. Just as much of our tradition as all this other stuff you hear about here. Really? Really? See, I'm kind of running out of time, but I don't know. You guys look like you're not falling asleep, so I'm just going to do it. Title of my first book is Nothing Holy About It, from Bodhidharma. Again, collapsing the dichotomy between the holy and the unholy. We get caught on that. We want to be good. We want to have our zazen impact our lives in a way that we're not caught by stuff anymore. So we abandon just paying attention to what is, including death. The Zen master who lay dying, his monks had all gathered around his bed, from the most senior to the most novice monk. The senior monk leaned over to ask the dying master if he had any final words of advice for his monks. The old master slowly opened his eyes and in a weak voice whispered, "Tell them truth is like a river." The senior monk passed this bit of wisdom in turn to the next monk next to him, and it circulated around the room. When the words reached the youngest monk, he asked, "What does he mean, truth is like a river?" The question was passed back around the room to the senior monk, who leaned over the bed and asked, "Master, what do you mean, truth is like a river?" Slowly the master opened his eyes and in a weak voice whispered, "Okay, truth is not like a river." So jolting us into moving beyond our boxes. We box everything up, right? Sengai, the famous sumi painter, Japanese sumi Zen master painter, painting about 100 days, 100 days of practice. That's what we do. We do here 2 49-day ones, but for hundreds of years, 100 days of practice. He has his sumi about 100 days of practice, teaching of the Dharma. And is it Buddha soberly instructing his disciples? No, it's a naked little boy leaning over farting. Another of Sengai's sketches is a bullfrog sitting as if in meditation, but with a smirk on his face. So the prize is given to the ugliest man in town, the ugliest woman in town. Fools are declared wise like Ryokan. Buddhas are bullfrogs. Like Sengai, they're bullfrogs, they're turtles, they're rocks. Challenging the whole structure of our discriminating mind. There was a monk who wore a Buddhist robe, who wore a Confucian hat, and had Taoist shoes. Collapsing our fixed identities. Collapsing. I practiced Lakota spirituality for a while. For about 5 years. And the Lakota tradition, they have the Heoka. The Heoka does everything backwards from everybody else. And Elmer kept saying, "Well, the Heoka going to be coming. The Heoka be going to come." I never saw the Heoka. The Heoka never came. But the Heoka takes for the Lakotas, the pipe is really sacred. And filling the pipe with tobacco, you're putting all species in the pipe. The pipe is round, the universe is round, all life is included, and you put all species in the pipe, and then you never dump the pipe over because all the species would get lost. So you keep the pipe always. And Albert said, "Well, hey, Heoka comes, he's going to dump over my pipe. I hope no Heoka comes," and then Elmer would laugh. And I kept saying, well, where is the Heyoka? He said, I don't know. He's coming pretty soon. So that's Lakota spirituality, right? Turn it over. Turn it over so that we can enjoy it and not get stuck on some way of being. So in Greek tragedy and in Shakespeare, we have the tragic impulse. Radically dualistic, right? Both sides are dedicated to a stubborn and unyielding defense of their principles. Comedies, on the other hand, include inclusiveness, rather than exclusiveness, reconciliation. Shakespeare's tragedies end in death and destruction. Hamlet's really caught. He's really stuck. And the whole thing is about how Hamlet is stuck. How his mind is stuck. And horrible tragedy. Macbeth is stuck in a different way. Really stuck on his sense about who he is and who he should be and what people should owe him and how he's not okay. And everything falls apart in those Shakespearean tragedies. And that's part of life. We know that's part of life. But then we have Shakespearean comedies, right? Comedies. How do those comedies end? Parties get reconciled. Marriages, feasts, celebrations. So here's modern Japanese Zen. Zen master, this is a modern Japanese Zen story. Zen master Taiji lay dying. One of his disciples, recalling the fondness the Roshi had for a certain cake, went in search of some in the bake shops of Tokyo. After some time, he returned with a delicacy for the master, who smiled a feeble smile of appreciation and began nibbling at it. Later, as the master grew visibly weaker, his disciples asked if he had any departing words of wisdom or advice. Taiji said, yes. As they drew closer so as not to miss the faintest syllable, Taiji whispered, this cake is delicious. That's the story. And he died. At least, now I feel like I'm worried about my own death. Am I going to perform well? See, isn't that interesting? We read these and we think, I should be like that. Instead of just be, maybe when I'm death, when I'm getting ready to die, I'm going to go, ah! Or maybe I'm going to give my favorite four-letter word. Well, who knows? We don't have to worry. But, you know, I read this and I think, oh, what am I going to do? I don't mean a real Zen master. What does a real Zen master do? Maybe he utters a four-letter word because he's in so much pain. Maybe he does. That's okay, isn't it? We need something. Maybe that's a teaching. We don't know. The teachings are all over the place. They're coming and going. They're available. They're always available. Doesn't matter how much deep your depression is. The teaching's available. The belly laugh is available. Just go and see some Charlie Chaplin movies. Just, you know, spend your time doing Laurel and Hardy. An hour a day of Laurel and Hardy. That's your practice. Instead of Zazen, do Laurel and Hardy for a day. Yeah, maybe you don't like Laurel and Hardy. Charlie Chaplin. I don't know. So this is not laughter over the ignorance of others, right? It's not which reinforces pride. But it can be laughter ourselves. Hakuin did all kinds of self-portraits of himself where he's bald, where he's fat, where he's cross-eyed, where he's hunchbacked. They're funny, right? They're funny. And Hakuin attaches to his self-portraits little poems he writes. Here's one. In the realm of the thousand Buddhas, he is hated by the thousand Buddhas. Among the crowd of demons, he is detested by the crowd of demons. This filthy, blind, old shaved pate adds foulness to more foulness. So anything is a legitimate object of laughter. Nation states, communities, individuals, religious lineage, anything, all aspects of life. So I'm going to close with another story about my teacher that I probably have not told. Well, probably Anne has heard it a couple of times, and others of you who've been around me have heard it two or three times. My banana split story. Do you know the banana split story? Yeah. How many of you remember my banana split story? Of course, Guy. Oh, yeah. Mark. Yeah, yeah. Only three of you, though, know my banana split story. Maybe I should have the three of you tell it. So I'm with my teacher, and I'm going to this monastery where I spent time as a young man, Tassajara Zen Monastery in California. And I'm gonna be spending like 3 months there. So I've been purifying my system to get ready. Because, you know, I know it's gonna be arduous and it's my commitment, it's my aspiration, but I know I'm a little afraid. I know it's gonna be arduous. So I've been purifying my system, and for some reason I'm taking my teacher down. It's just me and him. I don't know. In those days, there were only a few of us. With my teacher, there'd probably be about this many people on a Sunday. Yeah, on a big Sunday, not a Mother's Day Sunday, we'd have about this many people. And, you know, that was before this stuff all got famous. So anyway, we're about two-thirds of the way down, and what does he say to me? He says, I want to stop for coffee. Coffee? Coffee? I've just been purifying my system. I've been doing coffee for, not only coffee combined with no dose. I was in college. I used to do all the coffee I have, and then I'd have to down it with extra no dose so I could do my studying done. Coffee. Well, I don't say that to him. You know, he's my teacher. Oh, coffee? Yes, coffee. He said, I see a cafe there. Oh, okay. So I have to do it. You know, I have to do it. I stopped with him for coffee. And then we go in the restaurant. He orders coffee. I order water. Oh, water. I've been purifying my system. I'm not going to order even tea. I'm purifying my system. I order water. He orders coffee. The waiter comes around, and then there's something. The waiter passes us with a tray of something, and he says to me, "What's that?" And I say, "Oh, that's a banana split." He's never seen a banana split before. I said, "Oh, that's a banana split." He said, I mean, he's looking at the banana split. I mean, you know, if you really look with your beginner's mind at a banana split, it's something. It is something. You've never seen a banana split. He says, "Oh, I want one of those." Oh, you want? Come on, give me a break. You want one of those? Oh, yes, I want one of those. Okay. I got my water. You got your coffee and your banana split. And then she's drinking his coffee. He's downed his coffee, and the banana split comes. And she puts it right in front of him, and he looks at it. And he looks at the colors and the whipped cream and the chocolate sauce and the banana. He says, "Just like America, everything mixed together." And then he takes a bite of the chocolate and a little bite of the strawberry and a little bite of the vanilla and a little bite of the whipped cream, and he doesn't touch the cherry. He said, "That's enough. You finish it." And he puts it in front of me. Well, what am I to do? Person can only be pure for so long, right? The teacher is giving me a banana split. I ate the banana split. I got a little stomach ache, and then we went on to Tassajara. And I had a little stomach ache because I hadn't been eating sugar. Like, I'd been 3 weeks without sugar. And then I ate a banana split. So I think that's how I want to end my talk today. And I'll be glad to entertain any questions or comments or jokes that anybody has. The comic spirit, you guys. The comic spirit.
Buddhist joke I made up.
Pardon?
I have a Buddhist joke I made up.
Okay. You made it up?
Yep.
Oh, even better.
Yeah. This might land with a loud thud, but we're hoping not. So, this dog and this cow are hanging out together.
The dog and the cow? Yeah.
Dog kind of just looking up at the sky and he wondering, says, hey, you know, I wonder if people have Buddha nature. And the cow looks at the dog and says,
good, I like it. Maybe we should do a book together. Maybe that should be the next book. We've done so many books. Maybe we should do a book of Zen jokes together. Or we have a collective Zen jokes. Because people are so serious. And, you know, they're aspiring to be bodhisattvas. Ah, and then they exhaust themselves. Oh, be who you are. Have a good laugh and you'll be a bodhisattva. You'll be kind to people. The more you laugh at your own foibles, the more kind you are to others, right?
My dad had this pithy saying.
Can you speak a little louder for deaf people?
My dad had this pithy saying that was, if you can't take a joke, you're it.
You're it. Yeah. That's right. That's pretty good. Oh, your dad had a sense of humor. You never told me that. Yeah, both of you guys, one and then the other.
There's another thing I saw, it's rather more serious, and I cap it. It says, those who are easily shamed.
Those who are what?
Easily shamed are the most dangerous.
Easily what? The people who are easily. Easily shamed, yeah. Yeah. That's right. Do you want to say something more about that? I think that's important.
Well, yeah. And if that's what your defenses are. And then there was another article. Somebody had asked a British journalist why. It appears that the Brits don't like Donald Trump. He wrote this screamingly funny response. But the thing that struck me most was he said, we don't trust him because he has never said anything funny. He has no sense of humor. He's not authentic.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great example. Good. Thank you.
A couple of minutes ago, you said you would entertain questions, and I have to admit, for the last couple of years, every time you've said that, I picture a frog with a top hat and a cane.
Entertaining questions? Okay. Well, next time I'll bring the frog hat, you bring the cane, and we'll do a little dance. Yeah, entertainment. Life itself is entertaining. If we're not so stuck on before and after. And if you're stuck on before and after, there's something here now that will get you unstuck. Just to be here now. Just to do something. Just to engage. Yeah, Anne.
Yeah, I had an example of stuck on before and after this morning. My sister called, and she sent me a photo, and we had a really nice moment talking about this photo. And then somehow, you know, we ended up talking about our childhoods. And 45 minutes later, we were both just...
Oh.
And then all of a sudden, she realized that, and she said, Happy Mother's Day. And we just burst into laughing. And we needed that change. But the content of the mind and you know, what you rest on.
Yeah.
Is very powerful.
Yeah, that's right. But your point is that there can you can always break it. You can always break it.
Always,
yeah. But to break it, you have to pay attention to immediate, to what's happening here immediately. That's how you break it.
Yeah, that's what her saying Happy Mother's Day did. It brought us, you know.
When you what?
When she said Happy Mother's
Day. Oh, yeah, Happy Mother's Day. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Uh-huh. Good, thank you. Yeah.
Norman Fisher talked the other night about the story he told about the person doing the palm reading.
Yeah.
And so is it true or isn't it true? And
yeah.
His opinion was, it was true in a sense because it has to be true because it speaks to a greater truth.
Uh-huh.
I think that's what humor allows us to do. Because if you go back to Shakespeare, he put the most words of wisdom into his fools.
Yeah.
If you watch, there's a recent BBC version of Henry the Fourth Part One where Falstaff is introduced with me in the last few years, and I watched it on a DVD, and I was rolling on the
oh. Which play is Falstaff in?
I don't remember.
Oh. Does anybody remember? Oh. Uh-huh.
David somebody. So it wasn't any of the usual suspects. Uh-huh. It was amazing. I believe this guy was not alive and doing what he was doing. It was so good.
Yeah.
But that really is where Shakespeare puts his best lines, is in the mouth of fools. Because we're somehow off kilter enough that we can hear it in a different way. And it's his fools that seem to come to life. Sometimes.
Yeah. That's right, the court jester, going back to medieval times. The court jester was the only person who could make fun of the king. And he did it all the time, and he didn't get beheaded because he was kind of, he was like the Heoka. Well, maybe he did get beheaded some, did he? I don't know. Well, anyway, he just lost his head, you know. there are plenty of heads to go around. Anything else? Yeah.
Is anybody here from
Can you speak louder?
Is anyone here familiar with laughter yoga?
Laughter yoga? No, tell us about laughter. Is anybody? Are you?
Yes.
Okay.
Eventually, I would like to get certified in it.
You're a certified laughter yoga teacher?
Oh, I would like to.
Oh.
I have a long-time yoga yes. So it was actually developed, I believe, by a physician in India. I'm pretty confident. If you Google it, it'll come up. And so I'm pretty active in this church, Unity of Golden Valley, in Minneapolis. And so I was in a women's group, and we had someone come and do it. She was a certified.
Yeah?
You know, yogi.
Yeah?
Person.
Uh-huh.
It was. And it was really fun to do it. You do it in a circle. You stand up. And it's not at all like, oh, I have to stretch. You have to be super
familiar. Yeah.
It is about laughing.
Uh-huh.
And it is the most incredible thing in the world to be able to laugh together with something you really like.
Yeah.
And then how you feel for 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. One of the things that I learned from reading about laughter yoga and other people saying it is the best internal massage you will ever have.
Uh-huh. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah.
It's not just I have been thinking about what seems to be Zen-like about laughter, and I think in particular is that when you laugh, you can't explain why. You can't say why you laugh.
Yeah.
And if someone else doesn't get it and doesn't laugh, you can explain it to them, but they never.
Yeah.
They can say, oh, I get it now, but they still will not laugh.
That's right. That's right, yeah. Uh-huh.
Somehow that seems similar.
Yeah, uh-huh, uh-huh. Good. Okay, anything more? Yeah. You have to speak loudly.
Story about Mark. I hope you don't mind. But I think it was one of the meditation retreats a few years ago. It might have been Rohatsu, and I was having a hard time and kind of just heavy and serious and taking a walk. And then I saw Mark, who was also on the retreat, and he was waving a stick around. And it's just something about that just lifted whatever and just kind of lightened.
I see.
And then after the retreat was over, I was talking to Mark about it, and he said to me he was playing Harry Potter.
Oh. Did you tell your teacher that? Did you tell your teacher you were playing Harry Potter? That's a good story. Yeah. A good story. Any other? Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Happy Mother's Day.